If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario, and today I am speaking with one of the griots of our village, Ms. Denise Page. How are you doing today?
I'm great today, and I appreciate being here with you.
All right. So first things first, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up, and where were you born?
Okay. So I was born in New Haven. I always answer the question, where did I grow up, as Greater New Haven. And the reason I say that, I spent part of my childhood here. And then, as I like to phrase it, my parents kidnapped us to the suburbs. I would leave one of those two places out, but both of them absolutely shaped me and shaped my worldview and had impact. And so for me to say where I'm from, I proudly claim New Haven was very significant in my life. It still is. When I got married, I insisted that we were going to raise our kids here in New Haven. And so that's, so I claim New Haven. But the other place I lived is Milford.
So tell me a little bit about your early years here in New Haven, and what was your experience like?
Well, so my experience actually informs why I'm doing the program that we're going to talk about later, because it was such a phenomenal experience. I lived on Admiral Street, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's one block long. And I lived on Admiral Street. Across the street from me, my peers will remember the Bates. Miriam Bates taught the New Haven school system. Two doors down from them were the Horners. Mr. Horner Sr. is known as the first black policeman in New Haven Police Force. But I found out the other day through his son that actually there was a black policeman in New Haven as far back as the 1800s. But Mr. Horner, who I knew, was the first black contemporary policeman in New Haven Police Force. Miss Ella Scantlebury, who was a mover and shaker in politics in New Haven, lived on that street. Forgive me if I'm leaving anybody out, Vivian, and all. I remember you fondly. But I mention that because it was a neighborhood that really supported us. I never had any sense of anything except family, neighborhood, community. My backyard abutted what was then Winchester School. I think it's now Wexler Grant. And I used to, and we were, it's a raised street. And so I used to go to the fence at recess and watch all the kids play. And all the black teachers knew me before I started school. I was like 3 or 4 years old. The man I claim is my godfather, he's actually my brother's godfather, but I claim him, Charlie Twyman, was assistant principal of the school then. And so it was really a nurturing place to live. The Dixwell Community House was around the corner. Dixwell Avenue Church, which was my parents' church, was on the corner, essentially, around the corner. And so all of that really fed into that neighborhood. It was a neighborhood where we played, we read, our parents played piano. My mother had teas on Sunday afternoon in the house. It was a great place to begin. From there, we moved to Kensington Street. Kensington Street that, I'm going to say, Kensington Street predating like 1970. And that was a lovely tree-lined street where most of the homes were owner-occupied. On one side of the street, they were single-family owner-occupied, either by black people or first-generation immigrants. And across the street were three-family houses also. And usually those three-family houses, the whole family lived on all the floors. The same kind of thing there. It was a slightly different atmosphere, but also loving, supportive, great fun. We played together. That neighborhood was multicultural. And so our friends were first-generation Italian immigrants. They were Jewish. They were first-generation Irish immigrants. We had one first-generation Greek playmate. So all of that very much formed my view of the world really, really early. Milford was a different experience. No shame on Milford, not throwing no shade, but it was different.
Let's talk a little bit about your parents.
Okay, so my parents.
Let's talk, your father. What kind of a man was he, and what kind of morals did you get from him?
Okay, so my father, James Keyes. So a lot of listeners who are over 50 and 60 will know his name. He was actually alderman of that ward when I lived on Admiral Street. He was the alderman at the time. My father and mother had deep social consciousness and commitment to community. I cherish this. I was raised by two parents who celebrated being Black. And we got that for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, understanding who we are on this continent, who we had been on the other continent, what we had overcome, the contributions that we made, our resistance, our faith, our sense of forgiveness, our great talents in all areas. And so that was instilled in me from birth. I didn't really know that was unusual until I was much older and had conversations with other peers. And they'd say, I didn't realize I used to be halfway ashamed. I was like, that's not your fault. And it's not the fault of your family. The larger culture teaches us that. And if we don't have buffers, that's what we internalize. So the values I got from them, one of the family models was, to whom much is given, much is required. They made it clear much did not mean material resources. Much meant breath, life, and if you're lucky, a little bit of intellect. And if you had any of that, you're supposed to give back to the community. And they lived that, so it wasn't something they just said. We watched them practice it on a regular basis. My mother her spirit is still an artist. She was a dress designer. At one point, she had a shop on Dixville Avenue, and she designed clothes. Others always said the best dressed people at the Elks Ball were dressed by my mother. So she had that great, great talent. Later, she went on to teach. And my aunt and uncle, Mac and Sarah Keys, owned a funeral home in the neighborhood. And at one point, my dad was funeral director for them. So that's why I say my early years, I was just supported by, it was community. I didn't know that the rest of the world was different than that. All the Black doctors were on Dixville Avenue, Black dentists. My uncle that I mentioned, who was the assistant principal at Winchester, he lived on Dixville Avenue over somebody, I think it was one of the dentist's offices. But that's the kind of neighborhood it was. And that was the bearings we got. And I know that I am not alone. Anybody we talked to from that era, despite the struggles that existed, I mean, there was poverty. There were many of the problems and situations we face now. But in most instances, we had community to buffer us from that. And we certainly had community, as I said, to instill in us, you are a great people. And this is just a step along the way. You're on your way to somewhere else. And in our program on the 28th, I'm really, really excited because we have people from there who will speak to that.
Your father, you got a little story, a little antidote, something that sticks with you about him?
Oh, there's so, so much. The way that I have three brothers, two surviving brothers, and the way that we usually talk about either one of my parents is through not as much anecdotes, like whole stories, but through like sayings. They were really big on sayings. And so one of the things that I remember my dad saying, which I think I shared earlier, is my dad would say, my word is my bond. And if it comes out of my mouth, I know it is truth. I don't tell you something when I think it's so, somebody told me so, I heard maybe kinda, my word is my bond, you can take my word to the bank. I found that to be true of him. And it's something that I like to think that in time I've been wise enough to realize what an important character that is. He also, one of his favorite models was, if you want to get ahead, use the one you've got. And I can think of many conversations where he would pass it on to his peers. Brother, I hear you talking, and you're going, this ain't happening for you. That's not happening to you right now. If you want to get ahead, use the one you've got. So That was another thing of about him. Oh, what else can I tell you? My father was, and I, you know, my intent is not to brag on my dad, but he was a mentor to lots and lots and lots of people in the community. And I know that not because he told me that. I know that because even to this day, I'll be somewhere and somebody will say, you know who she is? And then she's Jimmy's daughter. You're Jimmy Keese's. Oh, my God. Your dad gave me my first job. The first time I ever had an opportunity to go to work in a suit, your dad opened that door for me. Your dad brought me to, later he became a business agent with the operating engineers, Local 478. He opened the door for people there because that was a closed, we weren't there. And that was the other thing he said. He would say, the first person through the door has a really, really hard way to go. And so I understand we celebrate them, but what we need to be celebrating is those who left the door open. Well, if you're first through the door, it's your responsibility to make sure that you are not the last. And that don't walk through the door if you're not going to make a way for others to come behind you. And I know that he lived that. That was really, really important to him. So and he lived in a world of firsts. He was first in so many ways I can't even name. People are asking me all the time to, can they do a story about this or that? Those weren't the discussions we had in our household. You probably know more about that than I do.
You're listening to The Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario here, taking in the conversation with Miss Denise Page about her father and her mother. Lovely mother. Now, she would make dresses. She was very social.
I would not say she was very social.
But you said teas. You said she would have teas.
I wouldn't define her that way. My dad was. My mother, she was social within her circle. She loved to entertain, and she was a gracious hostess. And she went to the big events that you're supposed to go to. But I think she was an artist, and she was a gardener, and she was a writer, and she was a designer. And the reason I came back so long, I wouldn't describe her as social, as she used to say, the ideal state of being for me would be to have a lovely cabin in Vermont. And I would be there all through those cold winter months, painting, sewing, writing, and reading. And, you know, I guess family would be there. And then I'd come out in the good weather, and I'd be looking fabulous with the clothes I made, doing my book tours. So social was not her first. But you may or may not know that if you're with her socially. But a hostess almost like no other, very gracious hostess. She was a great cook. She had great taste. So she entertained, really. It was really something special when they entertained. Wow. So, and she was the spark. Be hard to call her quiet. She was not quiet. She was the spark that kept my father able to do what he was able to do. This is just truth. My parents were both so smart that if teachers would say to me, oh, Denise, you know, you're so smart. And I'd say, oh, no, I'm not. My parents, they were really smart. So
times have changed.
Yeah.
You went to Milford, and a lot of people who transition, especially in these neighborhoods, they go from Newhallville to Hamden or, you know, in your case, you went from New Haven to Milford. What kind of culture shock did you experience?
Huge. Huge. You may know I'm a storyteller, and I tell a story where when I was moving to New Haven, many of my white friends in New Haven would say to me, oh, how are you going to be with all those white people? And I look at them and say, excuse me? And they say, but we're white people. Like, we live with everybody. This is... So I did find it different, and shockingly so. I didn't expect it to be so different. It was different simply in terms of people's exposure to anything other than their immediacy. Now, there were a few advantages before I moved there. I had two BFFs at the time. One of them already lived in Milford, Benita Tyson, who was Cicely Tyson's niece, and Benita's black mother – was principal of the other high school in Milford. And I said, Benita and I were thicker than thieves. And so she was there. So it's like my best friend is already there. And coincidentally, my mother's best friend also lived in Milford. Skippy Mitchell, her name was. And my mother and Skippy had lived on the same street as little girls in New Haven. They had been friends since they were 3 years old. And so when we were moving to Milford, I thought, my best friend's there. My mother's best friend's there. And this is, and it was an adjustment. I wouldn't trade that experience in for anything. Two very significant relationships that I developed with other black girls who were living there that didn't have community. We formed a bond that is very, very special because we were there together. And there were other things I think were advantageous. It was not lost on me that there were things that I didn't have to concern myself about living in Milford. I just had a different set of concerns. I formed a black student union. We were in a school with 2,224 people. Six of us were black. To my knowledge, one was Jewish. There were no Asians, no Latinx. It was black, white, and one Jewish girl. And I formed a student union with the six of us. As I said, we don't have voice. We need to have voice. And we did things like put on a play. The six of us, we had to play three or four characters each. But I just thought it was important to have presence. And you asked about my parents. I realized I could not. That was poured into me when I wasn't looking. So
people in this day and age try to navigate, certain places where they are the only one.
Mm-hmm.
What strength or what do you rely on in those times that you can pass on to someone else now?
I think what I just said, there was nothing that could be said to me that made me feel diminished. Anything that was said to me that was intended for me to feel less than, I heard it as, you are less than, but you can learn and be better. And so what it's projection. I am not that. Clearly you're that, or we wouldn't have had this conversation. So I can say in those ways, the things that were hurled at me racially, they literally, this is sometimes you look back and say, oh, that didn't bother me. I can tell you that didn't bother me. I just felt like, sorry you feel that way. One day you might know better and one day you won't. You may not. But I really, not only do I know who I am and who my family is, I know who my people have always been. And that just gave me the strength to not only overcome, but to make a mark the way that I wanted to make a mark. I also felt no obligations. Sometimes when we're the first, because our parents tell us this, you have to be twice as good and work twice as hard to get half as much. Now, I believe that. One of the other things we sometimes say is you need to be better than everybody so others will know. I never felt that pressure. I don't really care what you know, because I feel in the face of ignorance, people don't know what's right before them if they're not open to the knowing. I have to know who I am and what my goals, et cetera, are. And that's really how I live that, that I know what my goals are. And I don't live to what you need of me, want from me, or I can't give you that. I'm not even considering that.
We're in a day and age where the youth is chasing the likes and the attention. What you're saying is very poignant, because what you're saying is relying on yourself, the knowledge of self,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in order to, process information and move forward.
Yeah, I really believe that know who you are. And I think it's incumbent upon adults. So one of my favorite things in the world is to have conversation with young people. I have to say specifically young women, because that's what I was. And I hurt when I meet young women who don't understand their value. I mean, I hurt. And I know that can be reversed. But there's got to be partnership and there's got to be community in that. It's not a simple one-day thing. It's in relationship, helping everybody understand. One of my core beliefs is that everybody has a unique gift. Everybody has a unique gift. And if you can just tap into what that uniqueness is, sometimes that's all you need to be able to overcome and arm yourself to battle the other things that come your way.
Very good. No, just making sure we're okay. We are listening to the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. The voice that we're listening to and the great stories are coming from a young lady named Denise Page, one of the griot in our village, historian, storyteller, all of the above. Extraordinary woman. One of these things about knowing where you're from and people in New Hallville, you know, because everyone, you know, just knows the New Hallville and they just say Freddie Fixer, but they don't understand the or know the history of probably one of the original Black Wall Streets in the country was Dixwell Avenue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you describe a little bit about Dixwell Avenue and what it was like for those who are not familiar?
Yeah. So Dixwell Avenue, I think, as I said earlier, was lined with Dr. Timpson and Dr. Massey and Dr. Tillman, but many of our Black doctors. I think perhaps all of our Black doctors were there. There were three or four dentists, that Scott and Ince and Pitts and Downing, an ophthalmologist was there. There was, as I said, the assistant principal of the local school lived there. And it was the heart of the community. Of course, the Monterey was there, where people may not know that many, many huge stars, they did two things. They either came to Monterey, even though they were already big, because it held that place in community and in the music industry, and many people started there. I mean, it was really a significant place for music to be born and for community to be fostered. The Recorder Club was there. Don't ask me anything about it. I don't remember it, except on occasion my parents would be getting dressed up, and that's where they were going, and it was around the corner. But I don't have any conscious memory of it. And the Elks Club was there, not the Elks that they just raised, but a club before that, which I think we have pictures of for this show that we're doing on the 28th. But again, it was just a place where, you know, it's where we do. I don't recall my parents doing grocery shopping and that sort of thing. There maybe you could have, and I could name the stores. I know there was a Schifrin's and a Fair Variety store. But it was just, I think, more than the Black professionals that were there, what was larger than that, as I said, it was just really community. Now, we had stuff. It wasn't utopia. We had stuff, but it was different. It was handled differently. It was absorbed differently. And I, you know, I left that neighborhood at 6, although my other BFF still lived there on Southwest Drive, so I spent a lot of time there. But that's my memory of it, of just how supportive it was. But people who can tell you a lot more about it will be at the program.
You mentioned community a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the difference between the community then and what you see the community now?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I don't think I can speak to the community now because I don't live here. And so I don't know that firsthand. I only know anecdotally things. So what I know that the community then, what we experienced was that every place there was authority or leadership, there was also a Black face and a Black face that was connected to us. And I do know that that's not the same now. I know that there are more Black people in leadership and more Black people in with power and influence. And I know how many of them are really connected to the individuals that they interact with. I think one of the things that's different is we all used to live together. And I think that made a difference. And I want to be real clear. I'm not saying better than or less than. It was just different. Mm-hmm. We knew when we went to church, our teachers would be in the church with us, our doctors would be in the church with us, and that we'd walk home together because, you know, we lived, you know, a couple of doors away from one another. And we had, I think the other thing, and he said, I don't know, but my sense of it was there didn't seem to be this disparity between who had and who didn't have. I'm going to say again, I don't know firsthand that wasn't true. I didn't feel that. And I really have this sense that most people that I came in contact with, it was the sense that, again, this is a beginning place. One of the people who I interviewed for the program that we're doing said, the Elm Haven Projects was the stepping stone to becoming Black middle class. And we knew that. We knew that. And so while that may not have been the destiny of everyone who ever lived there, so many of the names we know and celebrate and have streets and schools named after today, their birthplace and their nurturing were those projects. And there wasn't that sense of despair then. I understand why it exists today. I won't talk politics today. I understand why there's a sense of despair. But I can say that wasn't our immediate sense of our future.
You were around for very historical events in New Haven. you recall one of my favorite times is during the Black Panther trials in the 70s late 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s to be exact. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what you remember from those times or a little story?
Yeah, a little bit. So by then I was whisked out to Milford. Mm-hmm. However, mm-hmm. every chance I got. I was in New Haven twice a week because I have to do this plug because of the basketball rivalry we had here. And the basketball games were Tuesday and Friday night, and I didn't miss. And so when I came into town, one of the things I did when I came during the day was hang out on Broadway, Yale Co-op, and Cutler's Record Store. And the Panthers would be at the corner, and they had their paper, and I would always have conversation with them and get a sense of what they stood for and what they were advocating for. So I always had great respect for what they were doing, which is not to say I didn't have a little fear. You know, but the word fervency can be fearful to, you know, I was like mm-hmm. 13. But just so much respect for what they were doing. I was actually afraid to tell my parents that I talked to them when I came in town because kind of the word was, you know, they're violent and all these things that were ascribed to them. And I thought, if my parents knew I was talking to these guys, I don't know if they'd let me come in town. And one day at the dinner table, my mother said, you know, I'm really tired of people demonizing the Panthers. I'm like, what? So she said, yeah, she said, you know, I told you they were smart. And smart means they read, they get real information. And she said, you know, I've explored what they stand for, and I don't agree with all of their tactics, nor with all of their philosophy, but I have great respect for two things. They love their community. Their intent is to serve their community, and they're willing to do something I'm not willing to do. They're willing to die for it. And that was the first time I really heard that in context of people that I actually, you know, had interaction with. So then I could share with them, oh, yeah, well, I have a conversation with them. And so that was really pretty much my interaction. We did have a family friend who was part of the Panthers, of which I knew a little later and was caught up in the Alex Rackley thing. So that was a conversation in our house. I don't really feel qualified to talk about that because it's somebody else's story. But that did come home and live with us in our house as we shared that with your family. With that,
lots of things happened in that time. Yeah. The race riots in the Hill.
Yeah.
The National Guard being called in.
May Day. May Day is probably the big marker in my mind. Mm-hmm. May 1st, whatever year that was, but I was still in high school. And of course I made it a point to come to New Haven. And I was terrified to come, because there had been so much talk about it, and the weathermen were coming, and you know, the Black Panther were going to be here, so they were antithetical groups that were going to be here, and they had predicted all kinds of Armageddon, and the National Guard were called in for that. And I can remember I went down to the green, which felt pretty normal, except for the National Guard lining all around. But I think probably the most impactful thing I witnessed was I drove out to Southern Connecticut, and I don't remember what my destination was, but as I turned around Crescent Street, all along the banks of Southern Connecticut, the National Guard were kneeling with their rifles poised. And I could just remember thinking, really? This is the response to a community of people coming together to address things that are going on in our community. That was frightening. And I could remember, you know, things at the Yale parties that happened because of skin color during that time as well.
You are listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and this is Ms. Denise Page sharing her story and now her program. Please tell me a little bit about the program, the title, and I know this is what you came for.
I'm so excited, yes. So, on September 28th at 4 o'clock at Concat at Science Park, we'll be presenting a program called Forgotten Pioneers. And this is going to sound strange, but they are stories of Black people, predominantly in the Dixwell community, beginning in 1870 and ending with 1970. And I wanted to go back as far as 1870 because I think most of us aren't aware that there were Black people in the community then, not just living in the community, but making contributions to the community. And, of course, there are many, 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 many since then. I mentioned some of that in our time together today, people whose names I think should continue to lift them up because of the impact they've made. I mentioned Charles Twyman a couple of times. I hardly meet a man in my age group who is successful as they define success, that they don't say, oh, yeah, and I was in school, and Mr. Twyman. Oh. So I thought, that should not be a name lost on us. Okay, and being fully transparent, I do want to see a school named after him, but we'll have that conversation another day. But so our program, I'm really excited in the people that we have presenting. Babs Rawls Ivy is going to be our mistress of ceremony. Ife Gardine is one of the tellers. I say Mr. Willie Holmes, who I don't know if those in the listening audience who know him, but what an extraordinary man at 90+ with an extraordinary memory and the same sense of heart and community, commitment to community he always had, will be one of our tellers. Mr. Bill Kilpatrick is one of our tellers, and Jesse Heyman and Ramona Tinney Bryant and Gary Tinney, and John Austin, who is a member of that basketball team I referenced that was indomitable. And in fact, because I am a griot, I happen to know that Juan Castillo played against that team when he was in boys' high. So, so those stories. So you will hear from people whose memory clearly is better than mine. You'll hear stories about them growing up and the people who influenced them in their choices along the way. We have a collection of photos that are the most amazing photographs that Jesse, one of our tellers, he actually collected these through the years. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful treasure trove of, I told him, there's businesses on Dixville Avenue that were gone before I was born. That's how far back they go. And, of course, music of that time. And so it's going to be a casual opportunity to just really come and hear. If you lived it, you'll be able to reminisce. And if you didn't live it, my interest in doing this was my heart. I want young people to know what we've overcome, how we've serviced one another, and how particularly this group of people that are on the platform, how they pay it forward, and how to plant the seeds in. Ask for what you need and take advantage of what's here. Because I mentioned how many incredible Black folk there were in that community at the time. In one of our meetings, immediately everybody in the meeting started naming the Black teachers that were at Winchester School. So we have, 50 times that many teachers of color today who are really committed to young people. And so my prayer for young people is that we recognize that gift and take advantage of it. that there's enough in the community. If you can't get it on street A, get it on street B. But make sure you get it. Ask of yourself, and I mean, I always said this when I worked in the middle, ask of yourself and demand of others.
That goes back to what you were saying as a foundation and your backbone is your knowledge of self and how important that is in development and moving forward. And if you know the rich history of the Dixville community, that has been an African-American community for over 100 years, it helps with identity and knowing who you are as a person, especially as an Elm City resident.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was thrilled to discover I was doing some family research, and I won't go into this whole story. I'm a storyteller, so people who come to my program can hear that story. But I remember the day that I was looking at old census, and the census I was looking at was Ashman Street in, believe it was 1900, and it listed as it does, all the residents of Ashman Street, all of them but one family were white. The census back then lists whether or not they were literate, and it had reading and writing, and they would check. None of them were literate in reading and writing except the one black family. And there was only one homeowner, and that was the one black family. This was it was 1900, but the census went back to 1880. I thought, in that neighborhood, back then, there was already one black family with their eye on the prize that could read and write and understood the value of ownership. And so I know that's what spurred my wanting to start the story that far back. I was just flabbergasted by that.
The 28th?
Mm-hmm.
Time and place again?
4 o'clock. Dinner. Did I not mention that? It's free. And it's being catered. It's being catered by Orchid Cafe at Concat. One does need to pre-register so that we can make sure there's enough food for you.
Okay.
And so I'm getting... let's see.
All right.
On the bottom in red, I think it has how you
register.
Here
we are. You go to Eventbrite. You're going to be able to find Forgotten Pioneers, Ancestral Family Stories of Dixwell. So look it up on Eventbrite, and please register because of catering. September 28th at Concat, down right here. And for more information, 860-680-2852.
Great. And identify yourself so the phone will be answered.
Yes. You got Ramona Tenney Bryant, Ife Garden, William Kilpatrick, Gary Tenney, Firebird Association president.
That's right.
Very star-studded lineup. You got Babs. You got Babs
right.
Holstein.
Yep.
Final words as we're wrapping up here.
First, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this program. Again, I love this community. I've always loved the community. And the whole purpose of this is to have us all remember, hold dear, and replicate when we can that sustained us when our community understood its value and we honored it, which is not to say we don't today, but that we will learn that it's been honored for a long time. And there's been something going around saying, ancestors, I understand the assignment. Those would be my final words.
Very good. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This has been the Electric Drum. I'm all choked up. This has been the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and we just heard from Ms. Denise Page and her great program that's going to be taking place on the 28th at 4 p.m. It's called Forgotten Pioneers, Ancestral Family Stories of Dixwell. Go to Eventbrite and look up Forgotten Pioneers and please register. Free dinner, and great stories. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. My pleasure, truly. Thank you.
And like always, thank you very much for your listen.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.